This is Thursday, January 19, 2017. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan, and we are privileged to have with us today Kenneth Pitts. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
17 October 1968.
And where were you born?
Fort Irwin, California.
And where is Fort Irwin?
It is in the middle of the Mojave Desert, about 25 miles away from Death Valley.
And what community do you currently live in?
I live in Natick.
And your marital status?
Divorced.
And do you have children?
Two kids, 15 and 11.
Okay, and now, what was it like growing up?
So, I was an Army brat. I was born in Fort Irwin. My father left 10 weeks after that for Vietnam. I went back to Texas with my mother, and when he returned from Vietnam a year later, we spent a lot of time moving, so every 3 years we'd pick up and move.
And your father, I understand, was an officer?
Yes.
And what specialty was he?
He was an armor officer, so armor cavalry.
Did he ever talk about his Vietnam experiences?
Occasionally, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And you're an Army brat, so tell us some of the places you got to live.
Fort Knox, Kentucky, Arkansas, Panama from 79 to 82, Germany, which was 74 or sometime around there. We were there for 3 years. That's pretty much Fort Devens, Massachusetts.
Okay. And you were growing up during the height and then kind of the tail end of the Vietnam War and with the Cold War still going on. What was that like?
It was interesting in the sense that, for instance, we lived in Germany in the middle of the Cold War, and my father's got some interesting, funny tales about that, but I was really insulated from a lot of that, and certainly the discontent with the Vietnam era and the low points of the Army in the 70s, it was, I only heard about it as an adult. I really didn't, sheltered from it, I guess.
And what was your schooling like?
I actually went to very good schools. Department of Defense had really good school system. Occasionally, like in Arkansas, I would go to regular public schools, and there was definitely a difference. I think that the Department of Defense schools tend to be pretty good. It was hard, I think, picking up and leaving here for 3 years, particularly around the age 11, because that's when you start to really form close friendships. But all in all, in the balance, I thought it was a very interesting way to live and made me, I think, flexible in some ways.
Did you go to high school or its equivalent?
Sure. So I went to ninth grade in Ayer, Massachusetts. I was only there for a year and then we moved into New Hampshire. My father continued to work out of Fort Devens, and I finished up my high school in a town in southern New Hampshire.
And what happened after high school?
Well, so I intended to go to college. My parents divorced right after my senior year, so right after I graduated. So things were kind of up in the air. I spent a year working in a foundry. I waited on some tables, and I took a college course. And after working out the finances of going to school, I figured, why not join the Army? They have the GI Bill. There's been nothing but peace since Vietnam with the little thing in Grenada in 83. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the Berlin Wall was coming down. The flowers were growing up between the cracks. And I figured it would be a good time to join.
And where and when did you join?
I swore in at the MEP station in Manchester, New Hampshire. And that was in April or March. I signed the papers in March of 89 and then shipped out in April.
That is an interesting time because you just said it, that the Berlin Wall had just fallen.
Right, right. But things were going to change.
So, and where were you sent for basic training?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
And what did your daddy tell you about basic?
It's hard to remember, but he was an officer. I enlisted, so our trajectories would be different. Between the armor and the infantry, there's probably some good-natured derision. So I think that you just said it would be hard, but nothing that I couldn't handle. And it was true. It wasn't that bad.
Did you have any special in mind? Any specialty in mind?
Sure. I was very specific about what I wanted to get out of the enlistment. I wanted to do something different, and I was a bit of an adrenaline junkie and was looking for some excitement. And so I wanted to go into the infantry. I wanted to learn how to play in the woods and eat bugs, or at least which bugs to eat if I needed to. Mm-hmm. I wanted to jump out of airplanes, and so I volunteered as an unassigned ranger, and in order to go through their tryouts. Of course, the contingency there, if you don't make it, the Army can send you worldwide at their need, so it was a good deal for them. A lot of people didn't make it.
How about you?
I did, barely. Mm-hmm. So basic wasn't too bad. AIT wasn't that hard. Airborne school was mostly fun, but there were a lot of, I think, kids my age that wanted to, or got the unassigned ranger, and through most of the, up through AIT and airborne school, most of them had decided that they wanted to do something else. And for me, I wanted to do it. Me and a few other people from my airborne class went through. We started with 128. And by the Monday of the second week, we were down to 33, and we ended up graduating about 24.
Mm-hmm. And what do you recall most about the ranger training?
Well, it was mostly in the beginning was there to really try and see if you really wanted to do it, and it was meant to be physically and mentally challenging and uncomfortable. We weren't doing anything really complicated. It didn't require a lot of experience. Just really, all you had to do was not quit and continue to do what was asked of you. And that was it. We did that for 3 weeks. Then you get to the unit, and then the unit starts all over again on you. But then there's a purpose to it. They're trying to train you to do your job and to be, it's, the only going into the ranges is really the only way for someone to come off the street to go through basic and then get into a special operations unit. All the others kind of require a lot of experience to get selected for.
So you finished ranger training. Mm-hmm. We're still in 1989?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us what happened next.
So this was airborne school in the Ranger Assessment Program, which they called RIP at the time. And then I was assigned to 3rd Ranger Battalion, which was also at Fort Benning. And I hadn't yet gone on leave and was looking forward to that first trip home. And within a couple weeks of getting there, we started to prepare for the invasion of Panama, although I didn't know it at the time.
Not too many people did.
No.
According to, of course, the research that the United States wanted to oust Manuel Noriega,
mm-hmm.
and the action still rises some controversy in Panama to this day.
Sure.
But what were you told at the time?
Well, we're getting into a series of operations that I didn't know at the time, but through my 4 years there, we would do them a couple times a year. We'd go through these operations, which were more specialized and oriented around some type of world contingency, so something that was happening in the world that we were preparing for. Mm-hmm. And this year, the October coup attempt had just occurred down in Panama, where Noriega was not overthrown and ended up defeating his enemies, who were then executed. And so at that point, we started preparing for the invasion ourselves. And we did a number of rehearsals, which took place in around Georgia, but the final one down in Florida. I think it was Eglin Air Force Base. Where we parachuted in and did an operation which was very, very similar to what the actual one tended to be.
Were you actually in Panama City?
Nope. So my objective was about 70 miles away from Panama City, called Rio Hato, which was a military airstrip that the Panamanian Defense Force, they had an NCO academy there. They had their Macho de Monte forces, which were their elite. They're very good. Well, we trained them. In fact, my father might have been involved in some of that as well. Really that was the extent. And also Noriega had a beach house there that he would go to sometimes. So there was some chance that we'd catch him there too.
Because again, I think Noriega managed to elude for a little while,
yeah.
But then he was eventually captured.
Right. So he wasn't at the beach house. Mm-hmm. And apparently, I don't know much about what happened outside of our operation, but we apparently missed him by not that much.
Wow.
So, but they did know we were coming. So, and I don't know if you want to get into the operation.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So when we were notified after the rehearsal, we got a few days off and we were alerted, brought back in, and started the packing and preparation for a 16-hour deployment. Usually it takes about 16 hours for us to go anywhere in the world. And we went down to the airstrip down at Fort Benning. It was cold, it was raining. It was December in Georgia, so, and we loaded up the aircraft. There were, I think it was 17 or 18 C-130s, and I was not on the jump clearing team. Some would jump, some would be on the air land, and I was air land. On the flight down, the flight took about seven or so hours. They had told us that they knew we were coming, that we had been compromised, that someone up at Fort Bragg or had made a phone call, and we didn't know these details at the time, but later found out that that's what happened. So they were waiting for us, and we were kind of expecting a pretty heavy resistance when we got there. But it turns out, at least by the time I got on the ground, that at least the initial foothold was pretty strong. Mm-hmm. And
talk a little bit about the equipment and the uniform you were wearing at the time. For example, what kind of weapons were you carrying?
So with uniform, it was the BDUs at the time, which was the woodland green pattern. I know for a while we went to a digital pattern. We call these the old analog version. we were camouflaged up. We had an old style LCE, LBV, which really hadn't changed much since the Vietnam eras. I was carrying an M16 I was carrying a SAW at the time. But that was kind of like a temporary assignment for me, which later became permanent. But with our helmets, because the Panamanians, because they're allies of ours for a while, and we also gave them a lot of their equipment. And to differentiate ourselves from them, we took old BDUs and shredded them up and wove them into the materials of our helmet so that we would look distinct, when we were looking at each other on the ground in the dark, because we'd be hitting, shortly after midnight on the 20th of December. And that was it. I mean, that was our uniform for pretty much the 80s and most of the 90s.
Getting back to when you initially landed in Panama and you were expecting heavy resistance, but you said that the foothold was already pretty strong. Did you meet any resistance?
Not really. I was part of, as a brand new private there in the unit, and I actually was not assigned to a line company yet. I was kind of drafted into a personnel office because my test scores, I couldn't type, which the joke was eventually on them. But so for the operation, I was part of the casualty collection team. And our job was when we got on the ground to move to a facility to clear it. It had already been cleared through by the first wave, but we were to clear it a second time and then secure it. And basically be aid and litter. So when the casualties started coming in, we would be the security if it's needed, and to carry the people that need to be carried.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like?
You know, I've very busy, and it, for the first night until the sun came up the next day, there wasn't much really going on, a little bit here and there, but it wasn't until everything had stopped when the casualties started coming in, and I recall laying on my stomach before the casualties started coming in, and we had Little Birds, which were attack or AH-6 helicopters, which were out of the Army inventory except for in special operations, and they were pounding this one building where there was some resistance inside, and our perimeter was close to it. And so they were hitting it with some missiles and machine gun, and in one of the runs, because they would just circle around, there were two of them, and just circle around, coming back in, and then the next one would come in, and then they'd keep going. At one point, I watched it happening, and when the missiles would hit, I could feel the ground hitting my chest on the other side of the airstrip, and not really knowing what was happening in the trees, but on one of the runs, the rounds from the helicopter went off into the perimeter, the U.S. perimeter, and wiped out a squad, and it killed Roy Brown, of PFC Roy Brown, who was in Alpha Company. He was hadn't yet been linked up with his unit, because when you parachute in, you're all right. Dispersed. And he was embedded with that squad until they could get him back, and it shot up the squad leader, Sergeant Larry Bernard, along with everybody else except for one person who was not hit in the squad. The squad is 9 people. So I think that at that point, that's when people started to come in, and it just kind of timed with other parts of the objective where they were finally getting from their casualty collection points to our central place where we had the surgeons. And then, you know, friendly, enemy, all started coming on all at once for treatment. And that's when things just got really, really busy. And it's not so, I mean, I have a difficulty remembering it, mm-hmm. because one, it was such a big thing to, you know, being, I just turned 21 and never experienced anything quite like that. And it was just a big thing to consider all at once. But it was also because it was just so busy, and I'll have flashes, and I remember carrying, we ended up losing four Rangers at that location, two from 2nd Battalion and two from 3rd Battalion, and I was part of the team that would carry them and take their body bags and their equipment and help put the bodies into the bags. And I have flashes of memories of in that, but it was just really busy. Yeah.
I know it's never easy to lose comrades like that, especially when you're on your very first engagement. So my condolences to your colleagues. And how long were you in this operation?
So we were there at Rio Hato for about 4 days. We were relieved in place by the 7th ID, and probably the only time I came under really effective fire was when the 7th ID out of Fort Ord were coming in behind us to relieve us, and they got spooked, and they shot over our heads, but that was about the only time I felt where someone was actually trying to engage me, and it was our own. It was a new type of doctrine, new type of warfare. Friendly fire was a higher risk during this period of time, and we hadn't yet come up with good technological answers for that. But after 4 days there, they relieved us. We took a helicopter ride up to an American base, Howard Air Force Base, which was also in Panama. It's one of the remaining footprints there. And they put us up in a high school that was empty, and we slept on the floors and in the classrooms. And that's where I found out my friend Jim Markwell, who was my ranger buddy in the assessment, the ranger assessment selection. He was sent to First Ranger Battalion, Hunter Airfield, also in Georgia, but on the other side of the state. And he was a medic, and I found out he was killed. Aww. And he was at a different objective. He was at Tacuma Torrijos International Airport. And around that time, I also figured out that I had actually been in that school before, when I was in the sixth grade. For one day, I drove across the isthmus with my mom and got some academic testing in that school on a Saturday. But it took me a couple days to recognize it, and after I did, you know, it all fell into place, and I was like, wait a minute, I've been here before. This is so strange.
Were you among the few people who had been to Panama before?
I can't think of anyone else that had been there before. Uh-huh. That I was served with. Mm-hmm.
And how long did Operation Just Cause take place? I think it was like a couple of weeks, maybe a month.
And the initial forces were on their way back home within a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I was only down there for about 2 weeks. And we started coming back in stages. And about 2 weeks. And yeah. I think some of the more conventional forces were there for longer. Mm-hmm. We came back, started refitting, preparing.
Okay. One of the stories that comes out of that particular operation was the rock and roll music being played. Well, they found Noriega, and they just kept blasting rock and roll.
Yeah.
Did you hear any stories about that?
No, I was nowhere near that. I mean, I know that when they put us back into the school at Howard Air Force Base, we started preparing for follow-on missions. But since I was in headquarters at the time, not one of the line units, I would be shortly after we got back. But those were typically smaller exercises. There was a prison that they had to take down and a number of other operations and the Commandancia. But once we got to Howard Air Force Base, I was pretty much stuck there and got put to work, you know, in support.
Uh-huh. When you did get back to the United States, it was around Christmas time, wasn't it?
It was the first week of January.
Okay.
Or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Christmas had come, New Year's had come.
Okay, tell us what happened after.
Well, we got back, and a couple things. We went on block leave. Our unit we'd all take leave at once in the battalion. We had three Ranger battalions, and one always had to be on ready for any contingency around the world. And so it was our turn to take leave. And so I went home for 17 days, and it was the first time I'd gone home since I joined the Army. And it hadn't been quite a year, but a lot had happened in that time. I went home, came back, and then shortly after requested to go to a line unit, and I was sent to Alpha Company, 3rd and 75th Ranger Regiment, where I was put into the spot that was left vacant by PFC Roy Brown, who was the SAW gunner that was killed down in Panama.
And where were you sent to next?
So I was there for a number of years and promoted up to Sergeant E5 after I went through Ranger School and finished Ranger School, mm-hmm. which is a different animal than the Ranger's assessment. And promoted up. I was actually boarded for my staff sergeant. So I finished my 4-year enlistment. There were a few other things that happened, but nothing to that level. I don't know if you want me to cover any of that at all or
okay.
not.
Well, during your period in the Army, wasn't that also the first Persian Gulf War?
Yes, and actually that is, you know, another interesting story in the sense that we were as part of we were rehearsing for a large-scale rescue. So if you recall that Saddam Hussein had human shields and members from the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait that were being kept, and we were training with other units around the DoD to take part in a large-scale rescue operation. We went through the same countdown that we did prior to the invasion of Panama. We were within hours of getting on planes to go to a staging area in the Mediterranean, and when they, Hussein basically announced that he was releasing the human shields at that point. And so they stopped the countdown, and my platoon sergeant called in his platoon and said, it's off for now, go home, don't drink, get rest, keep your stuff packed, and be careful what you wish for. And so we went home, and the next morning we got up, nothing happened, then the day after nothing happened. 3 weeks later, the air war started, and then the ground war started after that, and we were still back at Fort Benning. And after preparing and training for the mission and for other missions that were planned in parallel, and then when everything started, we were suddenly let off the hook. Our platoon, we went to a hand-to-hand pit for the morning for PT, and just roughhoused, it's a kind way of putting it, just to kind of let the steam off, because we were wound so tight for so long, and for not to happen, it was like we needed a release, and that was probably a smart thing to do, because anyway. So anyway, we did that, and then the Gulf War happened, and not much else. And after I got out in 93, as I was getting out, we were preparing for a possibility of going into Somalia. And I got out and I started school at Westfield State. And when that attack happened on the 3rd of October, and I knew a lot of people that were involved in that. Mm-hmm. And there was a strong, very emotional pull for me to go back. Most of my experiences in the Army, I think one of the more unpleasant ones is not being there when people you care about need you there. And I felt that I was needed and I was in the wrong place.
So Ken, you left the full-time Army in 93.
Sure.
When did you join the National Guard?
Immediately. It was, when I got out of one, I enlisted into the other. Mm-hmm. And went into a unit that was located in Agawam, Massachusetts. I went into Westfield State College for a couple semesters. Didn't really take off for me, so I ended up working counter-drug a little bit, and then I actually got a full-time gig working counter-drug a little bit later. But
excuse me, counter-drug?
Right. So there's the National Guard has units that are congressionally funded to support law enforcement, and mostly with intelligence and sometimes with ground support and keeping police officers from getting lost in the woods, that kind of thing. But that full-time didn't come till later. I got married around that time in 94. And then moved up into New Hampshire and went back to school at UMass Lowell in biology and psychology. Still in the National Guard at the time, got promoted into staff sergeant, became a squad leader, and really that was, I thought, the end of my, or at least the anticlimax. Everything was kind of calmed down. I'd spend some time in the Guard, maybe retire after 20, and that would be it. But I did end up going back to work for them full-time for the counter-drug program. I did that for about 6 years, and while working on my undergraduate degree. And during that period of time, I was mobilized for Bosnia. And as we were doing our preparation for that, 9/11 happened.
Wow.
And then the world changed again.
So where were you when 9/11 took place?
I was about an hour away from New York City. I was at Fort Dix, New Jersey. We were a couple weeks away from going over to Bosnia as part of S-410. And we had been preparing for that for some time. I was a platoon sergeant, an E-7 at the time. And we weren't really sure what would happen, what was going to happen with us, if we would, because they were already starting to talk about Afghanistan and the Taliban, and we were already mobilized and ready to go. We didn't think we'd be anywhere near a frontline invasion, but in support of security operations, I think we were quite well suited for that. But we also didn't know if we'd be pulled into the city to help. And it turns out that none of those things, we continued with all that turmoil and all those questions. Eventually, they just decided to use us as they initially intended, and we were sent to Bosnia for 9 months.
And what was Bosnia like?
Eye-opening in a different way. There was a lot of time to think about some really big kind of questions, human nature, the nature of people in societies, and because this was a country, this was Yugoslavia, that, you know, we drove through the Sarajevo a few times, where the Olympic Park, where they had the Olympics and held Yugoslavia as an example of how different ethnicities that had warred in the past can come together. And it all fell apart at some point, and some of the worst things that you could read about in modern history, it occurred there. The mission itself was frustrating and a bit tedious. We were doing security and stabilization operations, but at the same time, our force protection was ramped up so much because of what happened in 9/11, and the fact that there was a fear because Bosnia had a strong, especially around Mostar, had strong Muslim or Islam ties to Islam. And it was concerned that there would be avenues by which outsiders could come in and hit us, you know, when we're not necessarily expecting it. So our force protection was ramped up, and we couldn't interact with the population as we would wanted to, at least not officially and above board. Now, we did interact a lot with them, but it was just so impromptu and we felt at that point that because of the force protection measures, that we weren't allowed to do what we really needed to do to get involved with building the nation and understanding where the problems are and helping to solve problems. That everything had just got locked down real tight, and that all of that support slowed down. And we're a part of that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And what happened after Bosnia?
We came back. Most of the National Guard or the infantry units in Massachusetts were deployed for homeland defense type, walking around the reservoirs and working in airports. And we were, because we had just returned from overseas, we were absolved from those responsibilities, allowed to come back and recover. And because of a lot of those pressures, and I think that we lost a lot of people that got out because they felt they were being put to work on all this busy work without really, they felt kind of left out of what was important. And at that point, things were spinning up quite heavily over in Afghanistan and then starting also in Iraq. So, our numbers really got hurt in terms of people in uniform. A lot of people actually got out to go into the active. That would have been 2002 to 2006. And while that was going on, I finished up my undergraduate degree at UMass Lowell in biology and psychology. And started working here at the Natick Labs as an admin, just to kind of get my foot in the door. And there was an opportunity to compete for a scholarship, a fellowship, to go back for my PhD. But before that, we actually after I got hired here at Natick, we were activated again, almost activated for a mission in Iraq, and that one was called off almost like the last minute before they started pulling us in for a month-long ramp-up. And then they started preparing us for Kosovo, which would happen in 2006.
Okay. So you're going back to Kosovo.
Hmm.
And how long was that mission?
We were gone a year and a half.
Wow. Was that the same mission as previous trip to Bosnia?
It was similar.
Similar.
I think that we were permitted to kind of ramp down a little bit because right after 9/11, everything was really tight and almost paranoid. Whereas by 2006, things had, we felt we knew what was going on enough in Kosovo that we could lighten our footprint a little, or at least our posture a little bit, so that we could interact more productively with the populations.
Okay. Had the situation in Kosovo changed over the years by the time you were there? Was there still strife, or everything's just kind of still on guard?
Most of, whereas, you know, with the difference between Bosnia and Kosovo is that Bosnia, our job was there to keep the peace between the Serbian populations and the Bosnian Muslims. And in that sense, we were peacekeepers. Whereas in Kosovo, we were more or less providing infrastructure and security support, and that in a way that we were an augmentation to the police force. And instead of getting on the roads in our armor and riding around like we did in Bosnia, we actually ran operations, including we did a raid on a hotel that was involved in human trafficking, or at least prostitution, and there were reports of some bad things happening there, so we raided, but they get raided a lot. They were prepared for us. We shut down the border between Kosovo and Macedonia for a few days in a counter-smuggling operation where we went off in the woods. And that was kind of fun because as an infantry unit, you want to kind of get out there and do what we trained to do. And that gave us an opportunity to do that, to get away from the vehicles a little bit.
Right. So you were in Kosovo for a year and a half. Did you have a chance to contact your family?
Mm-hmm.
And were you doing it by email or regular mail?
Right. So the evolution of that, in Bosnia, I could get email like twice a week or so, maybe a little bit more. But the phone calls were twice a week. And they could only last like 10 minutes or so. By the time we got to Kosovo, we had internet in the rooms and Skype. It was very poor bandwidth, but you could get through occasionally, mm-hmm. and you could have a lot more conversations. We did get to go home. I did. I was in Bosnia in 2001 in December. I got to go home for a few days for the birth of my son.
Oh.
And in Kosovo in 2006, I was a company first sergeant at the time, and so I was among the last to go. That's kind of a thing you do. So it was toward the end of the year and a half, and I went and visited my family, and we went to Florida, Disney World. And then went back. So I mean, traditionally, we could get. Also in Kosovo, my wife flew over. My wife at the time flew over to Sofia, Bulgaria,
mm-hmm.
and I met her there for a weekend. We had a weekend pass, and everybody had their chance to go to Bulgaria, so. And so, there were a few occasions to get away from work. But
well, that's good.
Yeah.
At the end of 18 months, what happened?
Well, really, and this happened too after Bosnia, but really not that 8 year and a half coming back home and that hangover, we call it the deployment hangover when you get back. And for a year plus, you're working every day. It can be very stressful. You don't really have a time. There's not a day that goes by where you can just completely disengage. I mean, even on days where you're not really working, on days off, thing you have to be, you have to react to all kinds of things and make decisions. Being in charge of 100 soldiers, it was always something going on. So when I got home and had no responsibilities for like the first 4 to 6 weeks, I couldn't make a decision to save my life. You know, I'd get a call, you know, could you pick up any milk? And it's like, ah, oh, it's too much for me. But after about 4 to 6 weeks, everything started to equilibrate, and we started drilling again and recovering from the deployment and getting ready for whatever the next thing it's going to happen. I left the company, the infantry company, a year or so. This would have been, so in 2009, 2008, I had applied for that scholarship to go back for my PhD. And anticipating that, I moved to a unit in Wellesley to take over the first sergeant job there, which was a rear detachment type unit. It was a headquarters section. And very low level of responsibility when you compare it to an infantry unit. And the intent there was to ride out by 20 because I had another year to go to retire, and I'd be in graduate program at that point and putting my effort into that. But after I was there for a couple months, the 182 infantry out of Melrose was being sent to Afghanistan, and they needed an operations sergeant major. And they offered the promotion to me. I was the top guy on the list, and I talked it over with my wife, and we decided that, well, we'll just do it one more time. We seemed, you know, with the year and a half in Kosovo, that we'd kind of cracked the code on it and knew how to handle the deployments okay. So we started preparing for that in 2008, 2009. I went to school at Brandeis in 2009. I started school there and really underestimated the amount of work that I'd have to do in the graduate program there. So for the first year and a half that I was there before going to Afghanistan, I was a consummate student. I just completely put myself into my schoolwork. In a way, there was a little bit of panic there because I felt that, you know, I was very close to falling off the cliff. You know, whether it was or not, I don't know. I survived. You know, we had some floods, I think if you remember back
Oh,
this
very
season.
well, 2010.
Yep, we got called out for that, and it was actually spring break. So I got back, all the kids are coming in from Florida or whatever, you know, their tans, and I'm coming off my spending a week in the Melrose Armory coordinating the relief efforts or helping in the coordination. And then toward the end of 2010, we started to ramp up and activate. In March of 2011 is when I went back on active, and I left mid-semester at school at Brandeis there. And we went initially to Camp Atterbury, which was my second time there. I'd been there before with the Kosovo deployment, is our mobile station, and then to Afghanistan.
Okay. And what part of Afghanistan did you land?
So, did we land? I don't, on the way in, I don't think we went into Kandahar. I think we flew from in a mili in mil a charter aircraft from, I want to say, I don't think we went through Kuwait either. On the way in, I think we flew out of Germany, believe it or not, into Afghanistan. But I can't recall exactly. And we flew directly into in the Kabul area. So we were to be split up, and of course, our battalion was, you know, the actual platoons within the infantry companies were part of the security forces for different provincial reconstruction teams around the country. Mm-hmm. And our headquarters section and operations were put there in Camp Phoenix in Kabul as part of the base defense plan there. And we also extended some responsibilities out to managing the platoons that were out at the PRTs. Mm-hmm. So, but we went into Kabul, and I stayed at Camp Phoenix, and the rest of the battalion, much of it got split out all over the place.
And what were your duties there?
My job was in current operations, or you know, the day-to-day was to run the base defense. I was involved in reorganization of the defense. The plan that was in place that we fell on wasn't satisfactory to us, so we rewrote and did that. And I spent a lot of time doing that, and then making sure that the perimeter was sound, and if there are any issues that arise that needed our attention, that I was really the person that would be involved in that. Mm-hmm. There are a few other people too. We had our base the BDOC, the operations center, the base defense operations mm-hmm. center, which would handle the steady state stuff.
Okay. Was the camp ever under attack while you were there?
No, and there were shots here and there that mm-hmm. would get thrown, but I know the rotation before us that was also out of Massachusetts, their front gate got attacked, and so I spent a lot of time in the morning after morning prayers, so between 4 and 5 a.m. out there, just in case mm-hmm. you know, something would happen. But no, it was actually fairly quiet. It was a pretty uneventful rotation for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, describe the uniform and equipment that you were being issued now as opposed to maybe 20 years ago.
Sure. Well, when we went into Panama, we didn't have body armor. We did pack it in a duffel bag, but we never wore it. We did wear body armor in Kosovo and Bosnia, but not like Afghanistan with the new systems that we got that had plates on the sides and different flaps and things, Kevlar covering more. So it was heavier, larger, bulkier. Our equipment was bulkier and heavier. We could carry more, but at the same time, you felt less natural moving around in it than, say, the equipment that I wore in 1989.
What about the issue of IEDs?
Well, that was an issue, and in fact, that killed a good, actually, that's something I probably could have mentioned earlier, but, riding around, we had these armored buses for traveling between the different bases in the Kabul cluster, and I'd been on a couple of them bouncing around when we had some Apollo astronauts as part of the USO tour visit us, and because I was the biggest nerd anyone knew, I got put on that detail, got to run it, and driving with these guys around Kabul, there were very busy streets, very congested, and anxiety-provoking, but generally safe, until they're not. And we had an incident where one of those armored buses was hit with a vehicle-borne IED that included, I'd say, a half a dozen people from Camp Phoenix, where we were at. A couple of them I knew, not real well, but and people from other different camps. Killed everybody on board except for the driver. And through the bus, I mean, just,
wow.
It was a large IED or V-bed. And that was Colonel Castro. No, yeah, I'm trying to. I try to remember the names like every Memorial Day and write them down. There's about 23 names so far.
Mm-hmm.
I'll remember it in a few minutes.
That's okay. So how long were you stationed in Kabul at Camp Phoenix?
So we got mobilized in March. I think it was in May or so when we started moving over there. I was there until I think the first week of December, and then I started moving out to through Kandahar and up through Kyrgyzstan and then home. I got home around the 15th of December.
And what year?
That was 2011.
Okay. Ooh, so you're back home now. And tell us what happened after.
During August or September, actually, of 2011, my marriage started falling apart while I was overseas. And I think we did. I got to go home in toward the end of September for about 11 days, and then had to go back over to Afghanistan. And we were trying to do what we could over Skype and trying to figure out a way through this and make various promises, and one of which was I needed to lighten my load. I was certainly putting a lot of time into school. The army was taking up a lot of my time. The deployments away were large drains. So I put in my papers to retire. Not well, I told them I would retire, and I put in the papers when I got home. But it'd take a few more months to work that through. But before I even came home from Afghanistan, the goal was for me to retire. When I did finally get home, we ended up separating pretty quickly. We waited until after the holidays before we started telling family, and by the 7th of January, I was living out, and I was on my own. And we had filed for separation at that point, and eventually we were divorced. So that was happening, and I also started to get back to school and finishing up the semester that I had left in the middle of. And getting ready to sell the house and everything else. So there was a lot going on. It was a tough few years that followed, I think. Not just the divorce, but getting into the dissertation for the PhD, which ironically was about stress. And and I think one of the things that I think we underestimate is how much we put into our various roles, and how they kind of define us and give us momentum. And I found that, like, all of a sudden, I was no longer a husband. I was hardly a father, because I had been from school before I deployed, and then I was gone for a year. And then I was retiring. I was no longer a soldier. And a transition. It was a big transitional period for me.
So you're now retired from the Army National Guard, and you're still working at the labs. Have you ever taken advantage of some of the programs offered through Mass Department of Veterans?
No.
No?
I've interacted with the VA a little bit, and that's pretty much it.
Okay. And what kind of medals and or commendations did you earn?
Going back, the in Panama, or my first enlistment, I got the Combat Infantryman's badge. I went through. I earned the Expert Infantryman's badge. I got an AAM Army Achievement Medal and an Army Commendation Medal at the end of my service. Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal with Arrowhead Device for the invasion of Panama. I earned the Ranger Tab and the Parachutist Badge, as well as the Belgium Parachutist Badge. I earned a couple other Army Achievement Medals and Army Commendation Medals as well. Three Meritorious Service Medals, for as I moved up the ranks, levels of service as a platoon sergeant and a first sergeant, and also in counter drug. And my last tour, the Bronze Star Medal.
And when you retired from the Army, what was your rank?
When I retired, I was a sergeant major.
Okay.
But I hadn't completed the sergeant major course. I needed to go to Fort Bliss for 3 weeks in order to finish that. I opted instead to retire. So after I got out, I was administratively reduced back down to master sergeant.
Okay. And did you join any veterans groups, like the Legion?
Actually, yes and no. I was always, like, when I got back from Panama, my dad enrolled me into the VFW and paid my annual rate, and I never went. I probably used their resources a little bit when I got out in 93 in working with the VA, but my father let it go, and I never paid much attention to it. But after my Kosovo deployment, and again after Afghanistan, the town I was living in Wilton, New Hampshire, asked me to come and talk on Memorial Day. And the people that organized that were from the American Legion. So I came and I gave the talk after Kosovo, and shortly after I got a membership card from the American Legion in the mail. And I figured, you know, they gave me a year and that was it. Mm-hmm. But then a year later I got another one, and it kept happening. And then I got back from Afghanistan and gave another speech to the town. I had separated, had moved out, and I kept getting these cards, and I never sent them any money. I never asked or filled out any forms. They just found out, gave my name, and keep paying my rate so that I keep getting membership cards, and I still get them. And like I said, there were some hard years where I felt very disenfranchised and alone, and then I'd get this letter, this handwritten address in the mail, the American Legion in Wilton, New Hampshire, and here's my card again for this year. And
as we wrap up this interview, Ken, how important has it been for you to serve in the military?
Well, it was kind of a family business, but I can't imagine it being any other way for me. Mm-hmm. I did it for a long time, and it was a big part of my identity, and now as a scientist working for the labs here, it's my people, it's my culture, I can't say I've been a fan of everything that we've done as a country, and a fan of every war that we've gone to, but the people that serve and do what their nation asks of them, mm-hmm. I have a lot of affinity toward that. So even now that I'm out and a civilian, I want to do what I can, and see what I could do to repay back, I think, a lot of the great things that I've received.
Well, Kenneth Pitts, we thank you so much for coming and taking part in the Natick Veterans Oral History Project.